second part, which is, I think, going to be even a bit lighter than yesterday's in terms of the visuals and the graphics. I'm interested in communicating uncertainty and increasingly getting asked by different groups of people to help with this. From healthcare professionals interested in communicating risks to from doctors concerned with communicating surgical risks for patients, and then also right through to people who, as I said, we were talking about yesterday, are issuing the climate change predictions for the U.K., and they want to know about how to communicate the uncertainty and the sources of uncertainty for those predictions. We might be interested in just talking about probabilities about events. What's the chance that this child, what's the probability that your child might die after in this operation? Or we could be interested in the quantity, for example, what our uncertainty about the future mean temperature gain in a part of the country. And we could be uncertain about the risks as well. We might say, we're not sure, your child, we've got some data on mortality rates from this hospital, but we're not entirely sure what might be the best risk assessment for your child. So there's uncertainty, uncertain about what the actual underlying mortality risk might be. And then, of course, but how do we do that? Well, we can use words. Doctors are trained to a very limited extent as how to explain these things. As far as I can see, it's completely left up to them how they actually communicate. Everyone's got their own ideas about how they explain things to patients. But it might be written in consent forms as well. And people use words and use numbers, but there's lots of different ways to use numbers. And then there's a huge amount of graphics we can use, and I'll show you lots of these today. And of course, what I like is actually moving graphics, animation. So I'd like to show examples of where movement is used to show, explain uncertainty, etc., and to show what influences risks. Okay, so those are the sort of things I'm going to talk about with a lot of examples, largely from health, but not completely. Okay, so so I'm going to personalize it. This is the trouble with working in a sort of popular area. Whenever you do anything with the media, they always say, want it personal. Okay, so it's personal. So this is me, this is my bicycle in Cambridge, cycle everywhere, and that's my doctor's Lensfield Medical Practice in Lensfield Road in Cambridge. So I went along there, and because I'm 55, and so I went to, on this well person thing, so I thought I'd give myself a checkup, and he put me through, this isn't actually the one that was on his computer, but a very similar one to that. I don't know if any of you have been through this kind of thing, but you essentially put in your cholesterol and your blood pressure and your age and gender, etc., and whether you smoke or not, whether you've got diabetes or not, and the computer goes ping, 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 it shoves into a logistic regression essentially, and comes out with a 10% risk of a heart attack or stroke. That's what actually the one he gave me in 10 years. So in 10 years, 1 in 10 chance that I'm going to have a heart attack or stroke. Actually, but since then, my cholesterol's come down a bit, so that might have come down, but I think my blood pressure's gone up. So anyway, so I'm round about that. And this is based on Framingham data, this particular one, but there's ones based on various data sets. So this is a standard thing. You can go onto the web and you can fill up these till you're blue in the face, and they all come up with different numbers, which is great. So I found one that only gave me 7%. It's really cool. But that's not quite the idea. The other thing, of course, is that it's 10%, but then they say, oh, you're below average, which is 14% of this, so that cheers me up. Now, it's not entirely rational, of course, knowing that I'm below. Why should it make any difference knowing I'm below average? This is my risk, but never mind, it cheered me up and made me feel I didn't mind so much. Because actually, 1 in 10 chance of this, it's quite large. What I want to talk about is how we might communicate those risks. Now, a way that's quite a popular way to do it is to use this sort of chart. I'm not sure if you've seen these smiley charts or face charts where you put 100 pictures and they say, of 100, so the standard language is, of 100 people like you, we would expect 10 of them to have a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years. Now, people have done all sorts of research to show it makes a difference to people's perception about how big that risk is, what colour you use, whether you scatter them around, so you can manipulate. We'll see that in a moment, because this is what we've been playing with. So this is my baseline risk of a heart attack or stroke using a smiley chart. Now, we've got some choices about how to explain that risk and how that risk might be influenced. If I took statins, now in the UK I've got to be above 20% to be routinely advised to take statins. But I could go and buy them over the counter. I could get to take statins, and it would reduce my risk, probably 20 to 30%, or let's say about 20%. So even, you know, at my fairly low risk, I could reduce it further by lowering my cholesterol by taking statins every day. So I could lower my risk by 20%. Now, but there's lots of ways to explain that. Do we talk about changes in absolute risk, relative risk change, numbers needed to treat? I'll show you that in a minute. What does this probability mean? There's lots of different ways we can interpret that probability. Do we use, if we're using numbers, do we say 0.8? Do we say 80%? Do we say 80 out of 100? Do we say 800 out of 1,000? Now, these may seem to mathematicians rather an irrelevant choice. They're hugely relevant when it comes to people's perceptions. Do we use a positive or negative frame? A negative frame is I've got a 10% chance of having a heart attack or stroke. Positive frame is I've got a 90% of not having a heart attack or stroke. Well, that sounds much better. Cheers me up immediately. Do we use pie charts, bar charts, smileys, etc.? Huge number of choices. Now, the first one, which is very popular in the media, the arguments about the media using relative risks and absolute risks. There's a sign on a beach in Brazil, bathers in this area are at a greater than average risk of a shark attack. Okay, so there's a relative risk. Well, you know, how helpful is that? Average compared with Toronto? You know, what's the, you know, what, you know, how useful is that bit of information to decide what we're going to do? The other thing that, it's been shown in endless psychological experiments that people change their perception depending on the use of absolute risks and relative risks. The other thing that's been shown as a very consistent psychological effect is what's called a ratio bias. People are affected. This is why I said the 8 out of 100, 80 out of 1,000 gives a hugely different perception. And the standard experiment for this, now I'm going to see if I can catch you out here, so really concentrate. You've got a dollar if you win, and you get a dollar if you choose a red bean. You've got one bag that's got 9 white beans and one red one. And you've got another bag that's got 92 white ones and 8 red ones. And you can choose which bag you're going to choose to pick a bean out of. And remember, you get a dollar if you pick a red bean. Now, this is the Fields Institute, so, you know, I'm really testing you here. Which bag would you choose? Who would choose the right-hand bag? Yes, well, you are not, it just shows this is not a representative sample, because done in a general population, the majority of people would choose to pick from the right-hand one. Now, this has been shown again and again in experiments, because there's more chance of winning. There's 8 chances of winning. There's only 1 chance of winning, yeah. Obvious. So this sort of perception that has been shown again and again, that the size of the denominator can hugely influence the size of the risk. Actually, it's the size of the numerator that makes risks look bigger. Okay, so that's the standard, it's called the ratio bias, very, very strong and reproducible effect. Okay, framing is very important. This is a lovely headline, spot what's wrong with this news story in the Daily Telegraph, in a big English newspaper last February, 9 in 10 people carry a gene which increases your chance of a high blood pressure. Good. We're all at increased risk. In fact, we're all going to die. It's terrifying. Okay, when you go back to the original story, which is in Nature Genetics, you find out that 1 in 10 people have got a low-risk gene that reduces your risk of high blood pressure. By the time it goes to the media mill, now this wasn't the journalist, every time you see a story like that, you can guarantee it's not the journalist, it's the press office of the institution of the scientist who does the manipulation. It's always the press office. I find it's always the press release. Not journalists, just they're not good enough to do this kind of stuff. they're not scientists, Kate Devlin. They're not scientists. They're not clever enough, I don't think. So that's an absolutely lovely bit of framing, because that story in Nature Genetics would not have got on page 7 of the Daily Telegraph. But it did, this one did. So, a simple example of a positive frame and a negative frame. So, you know, that's how we do. Okay, so what we've done is actually sort of slightly play with this. And where's it gone? Come on. Oh. Oh, here it comes. Being a bit slow. Written an animation that tries to look at all possible ways. I know, I'm not doing bacon sandwiches yet. I'm doing statins. Do bacon sandwiches in a minute. Okay. Homeopathy, no, let's do statins. Okay. So what we've done is actually just play with this whole idea and produce something that can, you can show the risk in absolutely any way you want. So for example, this is me. Statins, my doctor tells me they reduce my chance of experiencing a heart attack or stroke in 10 years by 20%. Now, you can tell what we've written, the sort of syntax thing, so you can put any example in this. But I could change to absolute risks and say, okay, your chance of experiencing a heart attack or stroke in 10 years without statins is 10%, which is reduced to 8% with statins. I could do a positive frame. Your chance of avoiding a heart attack is from 10%, from 90%, goes up to 92% with statins. Now, I could say, now chances, this is generally not considered a good language to use with individuals. You tend to use population. So 90% of people like you, but then percentages tend not to be used, and we tend to use natural frequencies, say out of 100. So that, a negative frame. So that would be the most common form of risk presentation as used at the moment by computer-driven things, the text version. Have a look at graphics in a minute. So that would be the standard way to report it. Okay, so that's in text. Now I should first of all say in text, the other way, of course, is number needed to treat. Because if you do the sums, actually it turns out that in order to save one person from experiencing a heart attack or stroke in 10 years, you need to treat 50 people like me would have to take statins every day. Now it's exactly the same information. If you present it to people like this, nobody takes the tablets. And so the relative risk, absolute risk, and number needed to treat, there's a strict ordering in terms of its influence on people's behavior. Again, a very reproducible psychological effect. So let's go to absolute risk, and let's go to graphics. So we could use pie charts, be a standard way to show it, and we could combine them in a single, this is 8% with statins, or 2% is saved by statins. We could put them side by side, or we could morph between them, to show that this is the risk reduction is like that. If we use a positive frame, because it doesn't look so good, so that's the risk with statins, the risk with that's the percentage with that we're being saved with statins, and that's the change without statins. Doesn't look so good, does it? But column, this would be the other standard way to do it. Probably side by side, we might show something like let's go to negative frame. And let's expand the boundary. So this would be the standard way to do it, perhaps. We could say, okay, out of 100 people like you, 8 will have a heart attack with statins and 10 without statins. So you see, but if I just change the scale, of course, it then doesn't look quite so good at all. So we can do all that kind of thing. It's a standard manipulation that people might do. The way in which, actually, we quite like it is using, actually, we won't use icon. We can use this. We can go into faces and do smileys. Okay, so this is the way that actually now is increasingly popular and used on a number of tools, but we've just animated it. This shows then, out of 100 people like me, well, I don't look particularly like me, it's sort of 8 of them are going to have a heart attack or stroke anyway, and it's only in these 2 out of 100 who are going to be saved by taking these pills every day. So that's why it's 1 in 50, the number needed to treat is 1 in 50. It's 50 to save one heart attack or stroke. Now, I think this is a very fair, honest way to present the information. You can, and you can even scatter them around, which says, very much got the feeling that, actually they ended up next to each other. That's no good, come on. Not always, I don't want that to happen, come on. Go on, yeah, that's better. Now, that's really random. So, you could say, well, here's 100 people like you. Which one are you going to be? Are you going to be one of the green ones, one of the red ones, in which case it doesn't matter what you do. It's only if you're one of the yellow ones that makes any difference. Okay, so this is one way to communicate the idea of probability in terms of a population. Now, the way I have liked to think of this, that we're working with psychologists, is going to this idea of possible futures. Now, let's de-randomize them. Possible futures is really saying, rather than saying of 100 people like you, because someone might say, well, it's not 100 people like me, I'm unique, to think of 100 yous in the future. Out of 100 ways things may turn out for you, in what proportion are you going to end up dead or alive or saved by statins? Now, this from a sort of this is known as sort of metaphysical probability. You can think of it as parallel universes. You can think of it all sorts of ways. And so it's a bit dubious from a philosophical point of view. However, as an image, it's starting to be used in other psychological interventions to make people envisage the possible consequences of their actions. So this is out of 100 possible futures for you, 10 will involve experiencing heart attack. But then we thought, okay, let's really play with this. If we want to really personalize it, we can really personalize it and have 100 me's in the future. So this is 100 me's in the future, and two of them I'm quite pleased because I've been saved by taking these statins, and eight of them is no good anyway, didn't help me anyway. So, and in the software you can put your own photographs in. You actually can work it off the cam on the laptop and put your own photographs in and envisage your futures. So in fact, in this one, well, what have we done? Anyone read Ben Goldacre's Bad Science? Anyway, that's Ben Goldacre. We did one for him, and did one for Marilyn Monroe if she ever turns up. So it's to try to really bring a strong image of what might happen to you. And of course, with this, certainly with this thing, and my feeling is, I'm not going to bother to take the tablets. It's not recommended anyway. Yeah, maybe if I was anxious, and so I'm not. The chance of those two yellow ones happening is just not worth it for me. Okay, so this is just, we call this spinning the risk, because we're just playing with all these different representations and knowing we can manipulate them. There's no correct way to do this. There are ways that we know can bias people upwards or downwards. This allows you to play with it and try. So we're getting quite a lot of interest in this by people who do want to, are in the business of explaining risks. Okay. I can't resist bacon sandwich one, because this is an application that we've had quite a lot of coverage on. The World Cancer Research Fund issued a huge, great review, meta-analysis of influences of nutrition and physical cancer on cancer in 2007, and they came up with the statistic that 50 grams of processed meat per day associated with a 20% increase in bowel cancer. And although they didn't say it in the review, by the time it went through their publicity machine, it had become, try to avoid processed meats such as bacon, ham, and salami. So again, it was not in the original report, but by the time it went through the publicity machine, this finding, scientific finding, had become a recommendation not to eat bacon sandwiches. And this caused a great fuss, bacon sandwich. That's about 50 grams, about three big rashers. You know, so one of those every day, can you imagine it? Anyway, if you did, this lovely headlines here, careless pork costs lives, which is one of my favorite newspaper headlines from The Sun. And the Daily Mail, I don't know if you know the Daily Mail, but in the UK, it's a real, you know, middle class one that's always complaining about the nanny state and the health Nazis and this sort of stuff. So now they send cancer experts, you can't eat bacon, ham, and to it. So what does it mean for individuals? Well, there is about a 5% lifetime chance of getting bowel cancer at the moment. Okay, so a 20% increase in risk means that if you eat a huge one of these revolting things every day of your life, that increases that lifetime risk to 6%, if we believe that 20% increase. Okay, so people realize that intuitively, though those statistics were never mentioned. So this is, again, a lovely, lovely, I'll let you read it. Just the best quote I've seen in the newspaper. And I got a lot of sympathy with this view from The Sun. The Sun is, you know, the UK red top tabloid, you know, down market newspaper, but has, I think, some excellent journalism, and actually their health coverage is really quite good. It's not, you know, I might not write, you know, not exactly the words I would choose perhaps, but they got the essence right. So what we did was just look at the bacon sandwich business and say it increases your chance of bowel cancer by 20%. But if we go through that business again, look at absolute risks, possible futures, natural frequencies, out of 100, negative frame, go to icons, look at faces, here's the smileys, let's do me again. We could say here that, okay, you know, out of 100 possible futures for me, if I'm going to eat one of those disgusting things every day in my life, the only way it's going to give me bowel cancer is if I'm just unlucky enough to be in that square. Otherwise, it's not going to have that effect. Now, it may have all sorts of other effects as well. I mean, I'm going to put on weight, I'm going to be a complete slob, but never mind, you know, that's not that's another issue. But in terms of that 20%, does not seem to me a justification for anyone stopping their behavior. There's lots of other reasons why they should, but not that particular figure. Okay, so in a way, once one starts doing this sort of analysis, it can really undermine public health messages very strongly, particularly as what we're asking people to do is to trade off an immediate benefit of this greasy bacon sandwich for a possible long-term benefit. And you'll never know, if you're there and you don't get bowel cancer, you'll never know whether in fact you're in one of these or not. So it's it actually does rather undermine the public health message. Okay, so the other thing we're looking at is survival, because I've got some colleagues, medical colleagues, who get really fed up at everything being in terms of 10-year risk, because what they say, they would like to start intervening. At the moment, treatment for heart disease is all done far too late, but if only they were treating people much earlier, people were essentially taking statins in their 30s, and it would have a huge benefit to the public health. But if you look at 10-year risk, as we've just done, there's a big incentive not to act for quite a long time. And so maybe we should be actually getting away from this 10-year risk model and looking much more influence on total survival. So the trouble is, if you look at survival figures, this is the sort of thing you've gone to the ONS, Office of National Statistics website. I'm sure Statistics Canada is a similar kind of thing. Beautiful bit of statistics, but dull to the point of awfulness. So I don't want 1845 yet. I want to jump to survival now. Okay, so what we've done is just take the current survival data from England and Wales. And we're rewriting this. We should soon have a version where anyone can put in any life table from anywhere. So you can just be able to, as long as you've got it in standard Excel format, that you can put in your life table. And we just got various things it does. This is really unusual. We had two babies die. That's very, another one. My goodness. Very rare to have that. So this is just random people being born and dying in England at the moment. What we'd expect them to, how long they'd expect them to live. So someone got to 100. Very rare to have a baby die. So, you know, this is a bit Victorian pattern, this is. And then we got people dying at various times. You know, there's a few middle-aged, mainly getting into the 60s and 70s. We can push that. This is purely to... Actually, I can test my sound on this. Pushing up the daisies. Maybe my sound isn't working. This is the point is that this is part of my school stuff I use. Okay, let's get rid of the daisies and hide the people who are living, and then we sort them by age. And what I've done there, by doing that, by hiding, just looking, this is just a rank list of the ages at which random people are dying, is I produce the survival curve, showing how survival curves are generated, showing, you know, this is the length of life. We expect most people to live to 50 and 60 and so on. And in fact, what we've done is just jumped to this survival curve, which is the current survival in 2006 and 7, anyway, the current survival curve for a male born in England and Wales, with a life expectancy of 76. For women, 81 in the UK at the moment. And this has improved. We can look over the last 25 years and show this is actually, you know, had quite substantial benefits over the last 25 years. Now, the other thing I do with school kids, of course, is to say, well, okay, you're 17-year-olds or something like that. That's you expect to live to your 77 for a 17-year-old boy. And I'm 55, and I expect to live till I'm 80. And so, you know, why am I going to live longer than you? And it's a real test, because then there's some bright little what's it in the front row who says, because you're old already. And of course, he's absolutely right. He's discovered conditional expectation for himself. Essentially, I am old already. So I've actually survived the hazards that they're all prone to. And that leads into an idea of hazard, which I mean, hazard curves, or the force of mortality, which is essentially, you know, where the life tables come from. And this really illustrates, you know, your annual risk of dying at each age, given that you've reached your 75th birthday, your 55th birthday, what's the chance of dying in the next year? Well, it's quite small, it's that. But then it increases exponentially up until, you know, once you're in the 890 or so, there's about 1 in 4 chance of dying each year on average. Now this is where it's helpful to actually go onto a log scale, because then we get this beautiful, really clear pattern, I think, that people can interpret. It's extraordinarily straight. From 8 years old to 100, it's almost exactly a straight line, meaning a constant proportional increase in annual risk of dying. Quite exact. Except, of course, for this lump here, this segment here, which is, you know, young men and their lifestyles. You know, that lump is not natural causes. And in particular, when can kids drive in Canada? 16. In England it's 17, which is why there's this lump on 17. So I'm not sure whether in Canada there's a similar rise at 16. But for 17-year-old boy, male, that's where that lump starts. Incredibly low for 8-9-year-olds. Less than 1% chance of perinatal mortality. And for women, it's lower throughout. The lump is still there, not so high at all, the risk-taking lump, but it is for males. So that's one thing. And the other thing we can do is also then to look at the effects of behaviours. Now what we've done here really is just implement a Cox regression model within this framework. And again, our next project is to be able to read in any life table and put in any Cox regression analysis. Because a Cox regression analysis is a Cox proportional hazard model, and all that does is the proportional hazard model on this log scale is just equivalent to a constant additive factor on this survival curve according to your behavior. So it's a very nice interpretation that all that happens in a Cox model is the whole of this goes up by a fixed amount or down by a fixed amount depending on your behavior. When you feed that through into survival, this is based on some recent epidemiological data from east of England, on 20,000 individuals followed up for 10 years, and looking at their behavior in terms of smoking, their eating, alcohol consumption, and physical activity. And if I, at 55, can tick all those boxes, moderate alcohol, I've got to have some alcohol. Being a non-drinker is exactly the same as being a high drinker. So I've got to have some alcohol, 5 a day fruit or veg, physically active, that's 30 minutes a day, non-smoker, and then my life expectancy is 83. But if I can't tick those boxes, if I smoke and I just live off sausages and wash down with huge amounts of beer in front of the television, then it plummets down to here, 72. That would be my life. It's another 17 years on average, I expect, which isn't so good. Not many people don't tick any boxes at all. Actually, for women, I'm sure not many don't tick any of those boxes. Okay, so the other thing we've done, or one thing we have done, now I'll come to that in a minute, that was the EPIC study, which is the Cox model from which that analysis was drawn, is to look at history. We've actually got, in Britain, we've got life tables going back to 1845 from the 1841 census. So this is all the stuff that William Farr put together and did these analyses. So what we can now see is what happens to, let's go back onto this log scale. That's our current risk. If we go back in history, you see what happens is that, let's go back to 1845. Let's go right back to 1845. Let's go to survival. Okay, so that was your survival, 160 years ago in the UK. Huge number, because I say to the kids, is that a third of you would have been dead by now, and a life expectancy of 41. Actually, if you got to 55 in 1855, if I survived childhood, is a real coincidence, my life expectancy is exactly the same as if I was alive now and have a foul lifestyle. being living in 1845 was like, eating, or maybe they did all smoke and drink, and I'm sure they got more exercise. So, but what's happened since 1845, I think that's what I'd like to do, is on the hazard, we can see what's happened in 1845, and that a huge 16% of kids dying in the first year of life. And it takes, even with all the drains and things like that, it takes a long time. It's between the wars that really starts coming down, and the Second World War in the welfare state where it really starts coming down. But look at that lump just sitting there, it's not moving. Everybody else is declining, but the risk-taking lump just really starts becoming very, very clear then throughout history as we see this behavior. Okay, so, and this is all just based on on life tables. So what it is a visualization of risk and how that's changed over time. Okay, let's see what we can do now. I've forgotten what's next. Oh yes, no, this is another one. I don't know what you think about these. What do you think of these? This is, there's a very good group at Dartmouth, Steve Woolocean and Schwartz and Woolocean, who have been producing, again, what my colleague would not like. It's based on 10-year risks of dying of various causes. They've written a nice book on this and a very nice paper in National Journal JNCI. And New York Times, which has got some of the best, they've got a 30-strong team of animators and graphic artists now for their data representation section. New York Times produced this as a graphic, a static graphic, for these things, showing really quite nicely, I think, there's men and women, there's 10-year risks at different age groups, and there's whether you're a smoker, former smoker, or non-smoker. With the blob proportional to the number of deaths per 1,000 people over the next 10 years. And I don't know what you think of it. It's not animated. We want to animate this one now. Because I think, but I'm looking at about 9 different causes of death, HIV and accidents and things like accidents and things. So it's only between middle age, where you're 35 to 75, but we really see the huge increases in heart disease. We can see the differences between smokers and non-smokers when it comes to lung cancer in particular and COPD. And the former smokers, of course, just, you know, in between the two. We've got some very good, the accidents are fairly constant, dropping, you know, being dropping and then increasing again. So we're getting a lot of visual information there. And I'd be interested to know what you feel about that, whether that could be improved. It's the kind of thing people, that's fairly recent, that was last September, the New York Times did that one. So yeah, I'd be interested in the comments on that.
You said in proportion, is it the area or the radius?
I would hope it's the area. It must be the, I mean, they wouldn't make that mistake, surely.
That
yeah, I know. The big, oh, well, I'll come on to that in a minute. No, it must be, look, that's 50 and 100. So, yeah. It would be area. So these blob charts. Yeah. We'll come on to more blobs at the moment. We're going to see a lot of blobs later on. Actually, I can't resist. This is something since I started my funny job, I keep on getting asked for journalists for what is known as riskometers. You know, risk comparison things. Okay, you're going to do this. What's the equivalent? You know, how does that risk compare with other things, with accidents and etc.? So actually, this has been done before. We need always got a friend, what I call a friendly unit of deadly risk. And I don't know if who's heard of micromorts. Heard of micromorts? Yeah. Oh, Ron Howard invented those in Stanford about 30 years ago in decision analysis, and it never caught on. I think it's a fantastic concept. So we're trying to resurrect the micromort. So a micromort is a 1 in a million chance of dying. So it's just a unit of risk. Okay, now it's quite useful in the UK, again, in Canada, I wonder what, it would be very interesting to know these figures, but in the UK, England and Wales, there's about 50 million people, and about 50 people die of non-natural causes every day. It's always very nice. So our baseline risk, our average risk from a sudden death in the UK, average, is 1 micromort. So it gives us a useful calibration. Now of course, that's really average. You know, that's on average, and so, you know, I don't think mine is that. I cycle to work, but, you know, I think I'm a bit more careful than that. And of course, you know, these young men soak up a lot more than their allotted number, really. But what we've done is think, a real start of an animation that we want to develop much more of this and have a lot more choices. So you could say, well, you know, how far can you go per micromort? Well, if you drive, you can get 200 miles, I suspect 230 miles, for a 1 in a million chance of death. On average, it'd be more on motorways, and be less on ordinary roads. So that's it. So by bike, any ideas? In this UK, where people, it's not like Holland, there's not much protection. It's only 20 miles by bike. So it means that, for example, I actually do choose whether to drive or cycle to work. You know, it's about that distance where it's an option. I always choose to cycle, but, you know, I'm actually in the knowledge that it's actually higher risk, I think, than driving. Particularly as I don't wear a helmet. So, and a motorbike's great. Oh, that's lovely. Six. I don't know, all my middle-aged friends are buying huge motorbikes. And I thought, oh no. So, you know, this has actually penetrated into my brain. I'm not going to buy a huge motorbike and take off on that.
I don't think your colors are fair there.
What? Yeah, you've got to choose the color. The color is important. But anyway, walking is, a little bit less than bike in terms of pedestrian, about being knocked down, essentially. There's you can do these various things, and then quad bike, of course, is all is microscopic. You know, if you're going off on these things, so off-road vehicles is very you hardly go any distance at all. So it's just the start of a risk calculator to think of these things. The other thing, is, of course, is trying to do this for chronic disease, to compare sort of drinks, cigarettes, bacon sandwiches on the same scale. Now that's not to do with dropping dead. It's much more to do with effect on life expectancy and how to scale that in a realistic way. Something that I'd be very grateful for any ideas as to how to do that. Okay, so, Flo, a lot of this is, you know, who started off with this stuff, you know, illustrating risk and changing risk over time? Florence Nightingale, you know, who back in 18, when she came back from the Crimea, she produced these things, Nightingale's roses, they're sometimes called coxcombs, so it's better to call them rose, which are polar area charts. Where each month in the Crimean War, how many people were dying in her hospital, with the blue being essentially the preventable diseases from infection, and so she showed, and then she arrived around here, and then her sanitary measures started being implemented around here, and this then reduced right down. And she at first, when she started doing these, she made the radius proportional to the mortality rate, and then she was picked up on that. And she could do the calculation to make sure it was the area that was proportional to the mortality rate. And we sort of thought we'd play with this, and we've so there's her charts, and we thought we would show you know, again, what would she have done now? Well, she'd have used Flash, of course, for these things, and produced a nice sort of animation showing these increased risks. And but I wonder whether she would have really, because I'm not convinced. People have suggested using these charts. Now, there's software on the web you can do to use. I'm not actually convinced this is a great chart. We could change it a bit. We could. I've lost my mouse. We could do it. Oh yeah, they were illustrating it with. We could make it fade out so the circle keeps on going, and we illustrate it with the little things going on. Notice what I'm doing throughout this, and we'll see it later when we get to Hans Rosling, is using time always as a morphing measure. Time is movement. It's just that's the growth within Flash graphics now, that time is always movement, and the important thing about that is it allows you to stop time. It allows you to play with time. I can make time go backwards. I can stop time and saying what was going on at the charge of the light brigade, and that kind of thing. I can play with time. I can speed it up, slow it down, make it go backwards. It's a very powerful image. And that's, I think, underlies, as you'll see later, even more of these graphics. I mean, really, I don't know why she did use bar charts. But then they used bar charts for comparison. And in her day, nobody, I don't think, had done bar charts over time. Although Playfair used bar charts and pie charts and line graphs and things like that. The bar chart as representing change over time had not been, as far as I know, been used by the 1860s. Because this would seem to be the natural, much better representation of the data. I don't know what your vote would be, but I would vote for that as a representation of what's going on. Okay. So that's just a little deviation to graphics. So formats for risk communication. Getting back to, what do we choose? You know, how do we use these things? Well, how do we evaluate them? We could say, what do people like? Yeah, I like that. That looks cool. What can they understand? You know, in other words, you test them afterwards, and they can say whether they can repeat the information. And what are they influenced by? What makes people not stop eating bacon sandwiches or stop smoking? Now, it turns out that when people have, just bucket loads of studies, studying each of these, usually one at a time. When people study two at a time, they find out that these are almost completely orthogonal, that these are not related. We don't have, it's not a simple model of, people like a graphic, and so they understand it and remember it, and they say, oh yes, I've learned my lesson, I will stop eating bacon sandwiches. It just doesn't work like that at all. It's much more complex. These are three almost different things. So you have to decide, what are you trying to do? If you're trying to influence behavior, you might do one thing. If you're trying to make people remember the information, you might do another. If you're trying to produce things that people like, you might do another. But it doesn't necessarily mean because they like it, it'll have any of those other impacts. So it's a very complex issue. That's why, if you look at the recent review papers on formats of risk communication, there's almost no advice comes out of them at all. It's extraordinary. They review all this evidence and say, yeah, well, we don't really know. It's, you know, here's a few consistent biases, we know that, but there's no strong advice. Partly because people vary hugely in their preferences and understanding. There's no single person out there who ticks all the boxes. There's enormous variation of what people like and what they want. Okay, let's go on to some more examples. This is another risk engine, UKPDS, which is a very big thing on diabetes. So this is actually, if you've got diabetes, your risk. So here's me pretending I've got diabetes, and in this case, my risk of a coronary heart disease in 10 years is up to 15%, and in fact, it gets into the yellow, almost in the yellow zone, which would lead to some action being recommended. And my risk of stroke is another 5% there. So, and notice there the risk, you see the colored areas indicating areas of action, and there's the risk, and there's a confidence interval around the risk, showing the uncertainty about the risk. Now, again, what does that uncertainty mean? I'm not sure if anyone, you know, any users understand what that means, because it's fact, it's a limitation of the, in terms of the size of the database going into the projection. Right, because it could be interpreted as meaning, oh well, this, the risk might change in response to further behavior, or the risk might, this is what the risk might become when I find out more about you. Well, it doesn't mean those things at all. Now, this brings me into my sort of campaign against confidence intervals. I can't stand confidence intervals. I mentioned it yesterday. There's huge suggestion, if you just draw an interval, or even just say an estimate and then an interval, that somehow all the points in the interval are equally likely. And I haven't, there's a lovely headline, so I haven't got the headline, where, you know, somebody reported a confidence interval for the number of people in the country without, with hepatitis C, and the media just reported the top limit. So that, oh, it could be that many people. Now, people are getting away from confidence intervals. Now, I'm not sure if you've seen these. This is what the Bank of England does for its projections. They're called fan charts, and these are on the Bank of England website. I think it's one of the best representations of uncertainty I've seen. So these are the current projections for increases in output on a year. So this is growth in GDP, zero. So this is, here is the recession. They know it's, there's a decline in GDP at the moment. They're predicting by sort of end of, hang on, that's 2009, what are they saying? May, this graphic comment, this is May 2009, I got this. They're predicting anyway this is going to go improve, and so by 2012 they're predicting around about 3% growth, but still with the possibility it might be negative. So you've got this great chunk down here that the recession's going to carry on through that period. This is inflation. And they're predicting again, this is zero here, 2% inflation there, as a sort of baseline. They're predicting again inflation, saying fairly constant, with a chance even of deflation, small chance of deflation. So they're producing a predictive distribution, and these correspond to equal probability intervals, 20 equal probability intervals. And they've got some examples. They have these are pretty well calibrated judgments. They've looked retrospectively. These are pretty well calibrated. Okay, so I think that's very attractive. And I've got a colleague, Chris Jackson, who's just the paper, an American statistician, using an idea that's an old idea, really, of using density strips, where density, when you want to actually communicate a distribution like that, which you could think of the likelihood, is a likelihood or a posterior distribution, actually, if you think of this as a density, why not use the density of ink, essentially the density component of the R function, in order to draw it. So that becomes that top band there. I showed yesterday these eyeball or raindrop plots. These have been suggested before. This is the standard box plot. This is the way, the ghastly way. This is the awful, which I've done so many times, but there should be a ban on these, I think. And that's another suggestion. But these are the density plots. The point about those is that there's no end. They just fade out. Just like this fades out. There's no need to put a limit on it. It just fades away. So, for example, these the official now hepatitis, because this is the advantage of having in our unit, we've got Chris Jackson who developed this and wrote the R functions, and we've got the people who do the hepatitis C projections for the UK and the HIV projections for the UK and work for the Health Protection Agency, and that is the way they're being presented now, as the estimates of the number of people with hepatitis C in the UK as a dark band, and then a fade out. It's nice, you can see the skewness there, and there's no boundary put in there at all. I like these, I really do. I think they communicate the uncertainty, and trying to get the climate change people to use this kind of graphic, which they might be up to. So that's, okay, as another example of how we of a graphic that led to this. This is a story, a thing I was involved in years ago, 1998, for heaven's sake, 11 years ago, of one of these cases where a lot of babies died in the hospital. And we produced, back in those days when I did this kind of thing, we produced graphics like that. Standard forest plot. This shows for 12 hospitals in England how many babies were dying with congenital heart disease were dying at operation. And Bristol's this top one here. So way out, real outlier there. And all the rest scattered around. The overall mortality rate, which then was 12%, has dropped a lot since then. So this is the early 90s, 5 years in the early 90s. And that's how we presented the data. Now, I would not present the data like that now at all. I would use that plot, which is a funnel plot, which have been, okay, what's this doing? It's just plotting the percent mortality against the volume of cases. Now, this is much more getting into the control chart idea rather than an estimate of the confidence interval. I think it's very confusing to people to give them an estimate of confidence interval. They confuse the confidence interval with unreliability of the data. Oh, you don't know what the actual proportion was. Well, no, we know what the proportion was. The data is the data. And this idea of the, this is an estimate for the underlying risk and everything is I think, much too difficult. Much easier, if you produce a funnel plot like this, then you can say, well, this is the overall, you know, risk over the whole country. We produce two and three standard deviation lines around there. Now, again, it's unfortunate. I'd rather we didn't have to have any of these at all, but people like to have the control boundaries in. And then we can just put the dot for each data point. And what you see very clearly there is Bristol being sticking out like a sore thumb, being way outside the 3SD barriers. But even if we remove that, we got that extra bit of information that there is a volume effect. It's nice to test. I use this for really young audiences, and they spot that, which you don't spot from that. Did anyone spot a volume effect? Maybe they did. Maybe you did. Maybe you're really clever. But I didn't. But you plot that, and there's clear volume effect. In fact, this is, it's actually ridiculously clear almost because this corresponds, 200 cases over 4 years corresponds to doing more than one operation a week, and they've all got lower than the national average, and everyone who did less than one operation a week have got greater than the national average. So this caused quite a lot of fuss, to be honest. As you can imagine, I know people here work on volume. Volume-outcome relationships are a very, very delicate issue to explore. Okay, so what's happened is that representation has now become the way in which these information is communicated to patients in the UK in congenital heart disease. There's a change in framing. If you notice, this is I took this morning off the website for cardiac surgery, the CCAD website on the UK, that shows the survival rates from different types of surgery over a five-year period with the named hospitals in the UK. And they use funnel plots. Now you may notice a change in framing here. I was showing mortality rates. They do it in terms of survival rates. So this is a very deliberate action that if you look on the UK, everything's in terms of survival rates. So this is for AVSD, which is a very severe operation, which is staggeringly now has only got a 2% mortality. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult operation, and which a few years ago had a very high mortality rate. In Bristol, the AVSDs had about a 25% mortality rate, and they got it down to 2%. These are extraordinarily skilled people. But then we got here, we've got Leicester, small volume centre, on the green line. This is sort of within quality control things, generally be a warning area, this would be an alarm area. Now, some interesting patterns here, because, for example, here we've got Bristol, which is a very good hospital now, with 100% mortality survival rate. They've done 43 and they've all lived. Great Ormond Street, which has done about three times as many, has had a couple of deaths. We've been working with a psychologist on an experiment with patients, presenting them with these diagrams and the instructions to see if they understand it, and they do. These are completely comprehensible to people. We've given very simple instructions. They can read these, and they can read off the figures. They know who had the best survival, who did the most. And then you ask, which hospital would you go to? And very interestingly, they don't all choose these. Some will choose these, choose that. Now, essentially, which I would as well. I don't know about you, I would choose, because I would do, being a Bayesian, I'd do a little bit of shrinkage estimation in my head. I'd pull all these two and I'd choose that one. Because I think if you did a random effects model or a shrink or empirical Bayes model there, Great Ormond Street would come out with the best mortality rate. But people do that in their heads automatically, because it's a very intuitive thing to do. I mean, I wouldn't want to go there. UCL has done about two, and they survived. Now, I'd rather go there, which has got a lower survival rate, because you know they do them, you know, by the bucket load, and they're really good. So these fairly sophisticated pictures are being presented to patients, and they do understand them. Now, if you look at what happens in the US, for example, in New York, this is in pediatric congenital heart disease in New York State, 2002-2005. Again, they use mortality rate, the observed mortality rate in these different hospitals. They don't use people, in the UK people survive, in the US people die. So it's a big difference. And so here we've got, and you get the average is 4%, and you get 2 stars if your hospital is significantly below the average, and you get 1 star if your hospital is significantly above the average. So where do we go? Okay, so we just redrew that data like that as a funnel plot, which I think shows very nicely the sort of expected scatter. It shows the bigger variability in the smaller hospitals, so they're not being penalized just because they're small. This one is the highest mortality rate, but if you wanted to choose between that one and that one, then I think I don't know, actually. I'm not sure which way, but I wouldn't want to have to choose. And this is obviously the place where one would like to go. So, but again, we're thinking of trying to get away from the funnel. Maybe even using shading or something like that, trying to get away from the sharp divisions between okay and not okay. So I think actually, I'm not sure about this, but I'm sure there's a way to improve the funnel representation. Okay, so I'm coming to the end now. I think visualizing uncertain quantities. If we look at, we just looked so far at simple risks, although on the funnels there's some idea of these being estimates. And the people who really studied visualization of uncertainty are the cartographers in geographical information systems, where there's been a lot of work on this, on how you can use symbols to represent. Represent uncertainty, additional symbols. Can you split the displays? So I know in the UK climate impact program, they're going to 3 maps, a best estimate at the 10% level and the 90% level. So you're going to 3 maps, 3 displays. Toggle the displays, quite nice on computer ones. You can move between them, the high estimate, the low estimate, and the mid estimate. So you can move between them. This is the kind of things where people might use uncertainty using symbols. They might use blurring, or the saturation of the color, or some other graphic to illustrate the uncertainty. I like blurring, but the other thing is to use is movement to represent uncertainty, to make things move within the bounds of the uncertainty. So this is the kind of thing that people, this is just stolen from other people. Alex Pang is one of the people, I think he's from Canada, works on this stuff. And so for example, here we're looking at wind velocity. This is just with no uncertainty, and this is showing uncertainty of in direction. So just a change in the graphic. It's again, you're using the problem with that is that it suggests all these are equally likely. There's no blurring there. It's just using an equally likely thing. So I don't really like that. This is one on 3D images. This is using MRI images on orange and allowing again blurring around the outside using shading, blurring to illustrate uncertainty about the position, 3D position of something. So I'd like to then come on, really just finish off with, have people know about Hans Rosling? Is this just, who knows about Hans Rosling? Everyone know about? Yeah, okay. Oh, for those who don't, then I don't apologize at all. I'm going to show a few clips of him, because he's been hugely influential on us, and he's very influential in this whole area. And he's a Swedish public health physician who started this Gapminder project to display WHO public health data. But his son was a video game programmer, and he wrote writing in Flash, using, again, this idea of morphing movement to illustrate time. His son now works for Google, and Google are now incorporating a lot of these ideas into their software. So I'm going to just show a couple of short clips. I hope my pathetic little speaker is going to work here, and make the volume work, but it might not. But what I'm going to do first of all is just show a standard, one of his standard videos that's very popular from one of his TED talks, which illustrates not uncertainty, just the use of movement over time. Now, if the sound doesn't work, I'm a bit messed up, but let's try it. Let's try and hope that something works.
Discovered that the textbook was Tintin mainly.
Can you hear?
And they said the world is still we and them. And we is Western world, and them is third world. And what do you mean with Western world, I said? Well, that's long life in small family, and third world is short life in large family. So this is what I could display here. I put fertility rate here, number of children per woman, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to about 8 children per woman. We have very good data since 1960 about, on the size of families in all countries. The error margin is narrow. Here I put life expectancy at birth, from 30 years in some countries up to about 70 years. And 1962, that was really a group of countries here that was industrialized countries, and they had small families and long lives. And these were the developing countries. They had large families, and they had relatively short lives. Now, what has happened since 1962? We want to see the change. Are the students right? It's still two types of countries? Or have these developing countries got smaller families and they live here? Or have they got longer lives and live up there? Let's see. We stop the world. And this is all UN statistics that have been available. Here we go. Can you see that? It's China. They're moving against better health. They're improving there. All the green Latin American countries, they are moving towards smaller families. The yellow ones here are the Arabic countries, and they get larger families, but they, no, longer lives, but not larger families. The Africans are the green down here. They still remain here. This is India. Indonesia is moving on pretty fast. And in the 80s here, you have Bangladesh still among the African countries there, but not Bangladesh. It's a miracle that happened in the 80s. The imams start to promote family planning, and they move up into that corner. And in 90s, we have the terrible HIV epidemic that takes down the life expectancy of the African countries, and all the rest of the world moves up into the corner where we have long life and small family, and we have a completely new world.
Okay, that's just one of them. That's his big talk that sort of brought him to everyone's attention. But I'd just like to show this one because it's one where it's one on his website. He produces Gapcasts that he puts up on YouTube, and because it's one where he does use movement to illustrate uncertainty. And this is about maternal mortality.
From just a few.
I'm running off the web here.
1,000 or to 2,000. And 2,000 means 2% of women dying. And you can see that the high-income countries have very low, the middle-income countries have a little higher, and the low-income countries, there where most of the maternal mortality takes place. Now, the important thing with this new study by Kenneth Hill and others, which was published in the medical journal Lancet, is that they published the uncertainty also. And I can animate the uncertainty for you. Look here. This shows, they say, it can be low, it can be higher. These movements show the range of uncertainty that those researchers have published for the data in each country on maternal mortality. And the animation tells the story. Maternal mortality in low-income countries is a very uncertain measure. And it's also in middle-income countries. One could ask, is the data then used at all? Yes, it is, and I will show you. I will show you by moving the data to what is called logarithmic scale. And logarithmic scale means that I compress the mortality up there for those which have high mortality. So it's 1,000, it's 100, and it's 10. And this gives an almost linear relation between maternal mortality and income. But it is at the same level, differences in maternal mortality, at the same income level. Sri Lanka there and no, that is Morocco. I was intending to show Guatemala. The little number 5 there is a glitch. Forget about it. Right? Sri Lanka has only 58, whereas Guatemala has 290. But now you may think, oh, that's just due to the uncertainty. But look, when we fix the other countries and we move these countries up and down, you can clearly see that for Sri Lanka, the uncertainty is not so wide, whereas Guatemala, even if it's very wide, it clearly does not overlap Sri Lanka. So we can say that at same income level, we have countries with clearly lower maternal mortality than in other countries. Now,
right, okay. So, yeah, that's... So I'll just... I won't do the lies, I'll do that on Monday. So, so just to finish off, yeah, no, actually, I went, yeah, okay. So my very vague conclusions of that is that I think visualizations are really important. I just think this is the way, and Hans Rosling has really grabbed attention with this kind of stuff, and you can tell we're just copying a lot of what he does. But there's no correct format for this, and it's actually really helpful to think, what are you actually trying to do? You know, there's, and my personal preference is that I like this concept of multiple futures for communicating consequences of actions. And I like blurring and movement. And there's lots of ways to implement that. But again, that's not really evidence-based, partly because the evidence is not that strong. Okay, thank you very much.